Welcome to the Evolved Caveman, where men learn to be successful and happy with your host, Dr. John Schinnerer, as he shares the most impactful ideas and practices for you to get the most from your relationships, your work, and from your life. Now here's Dr. John.
Hey everybody, this is Dr. John back with the latest episode of the Evolved Caveman. And today I am really honored to have with me Frederick Sandvall. And one of the things I want to talk about today is Frederick's experiences in the Swedish Special Forces. So Frederick, can you give a little bit of your background and who you are?
Absolutely. So I am a Swede stuck in Sweden. And no, I live usually in London and I work all over the world. I am in real estate, finance, doing some consulting, travel all over the world. And we met online, the two of us, John, and that's where I also like to help lots of people. So yeah, that's me in a nutshell.
All right, so thanks for the intro. So tell me a story of what you look like at your very best.
I am really at my peak when I help others. I unlock other people's untapped potential. So really helping people to do stuff that they really didn't think was doable. So we will come back to it later, for example, in Special Forces, where you take a young man and over a duration of a number of weeks, months, and a year, you completely transform that person into doing some things which he really thought wasn't possible whatsoever, like in terms of running, climbing. So unlocking other people's potential, that makes me really happy. And I enjoy it a lot.
So tell me about a time when you struggled in life and then overcame that struggle.
In terms of struggle, I don't like failing. And I think I'm probably the only man in the world who have that trait, right? No, I don't like failing. And a tough time for me, for example, I have very few times in my life where I had to break for physical reasons in terms of like a competition, etc. And one time I was doing an obstacle course, and at one moment I could not move my legs. So I literally just fell down on the ground, and my fellow mates thought that I was probably the scum of the world for a second. And then eventually my legs started to work and we can crack on. So failing is something I'm not very happy about. But the cool thing with failing, we can actually learn a lot from actually doing that. Also in terms of failing, is failing on my promise something I really don't like? And at this very moment, I have that in business. So I am normally never late for a payment, but for different circumstances, people have disappointed me, which means I'm stuck in a chain of disappointment. So I have made some people who I should have repaid on time dissatisfied, and that I find extremely frustrating and try to make right as fast as I can, basically. So that's another example of a challenge.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, you know, you mentioned failure and that you hate failing, and I think that's true for all of us men or the vast majority, and I think there's a lot of lessons in failing. I think that one guarantee in life is that life's going to be painful, and I think failure is part of that and disappointing others. So then the question becomes, how do you rebound more quickly from failure? You know, what are the lessons that we can pick up from failure? How do you pick yourself up and get back on the horse emotionally as quickly as possible?
Yeah. I mean, from my point of view, I'm quick to recognize a failure so far, so I don't consider it a failure more than just usually a moment. That's why I was struggling a little bit when you asked, like, tell me about the failure, because I'm so quick to leave it and take the learning, just move on, fast forward. So I don't dwell normally on stuff which has not turned out to plan. And when we work with someone who might dig deeper into the failure and you already like passed it, that can sometimes also create almost like a little conflict, because the other person might want to stick there and dig deeper into the failure. And that's not typical me.
Yeah. And I think you bring up a good point. I think failure is not the best word to use. I think challenge or difficulty, something that you're going to get through regardless, because we all have 100% success rate at getting through our challenges and difficulties. Yes. And I like that idea that, you know, well, I've done it before, I can do it again, regardless of what the difficulty is, I'm going to keep moving forward.
Exactly. And this whole bouncing back factor that we can also talk about as well, how quick you bounce back after failure is very important, especially in business and life. If you get stuck with something, you can lose many, many years, literally, from, for example, thinking about a failure in a relationship or a hardship. You can find yourself very, very lonely if you don't dare to talk to other people about it and if you can't leave it behind you.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, even looking at my marriage, you know, which I was married for 16 years and I'm now divorced. I can look at that, and I did look at that for a while as me failing as a man, as a husband, as a father. And then with some distance, I can look at it as, well, wait a second, that was actually a pretty good run. I mean, 16 years is a pretty long time to be married. So it depends on how you frame the situation. And I think that, you know, I'm pretty good at this point at finding the silver lining in the wreckage or the shit heap of our lives. And I think that it's funny because it annoys people at a certain point and I'm like, oh shit, wait, I got to go back to empathy and then find the silver lining. So tell me about, like, I'm really curious about the mindset that you had or learned or adopted in the training of the special forces. Cause to me, that is just physically, that's fucking impressive.
I mean, number one, let's talk about like survival. Why do people even want to get into it? Because usually it is a voluntary act to try to get into any kind of like extreme challenge in life. It is something we've usually taken on ourselves. So from like day one, you're very much, they encourage you and ask you like, are you sure you don't want to give up? I mean, it's never too late to give up. Do you want to give up now? But you don't want to give up. You don't want to surrender. You would like to hang in there. And it does get tough. So the typical challenge we might think about is like it's physical, it is mental. And it's also adding the spice of sometimes you might not get the food or the sleep. So basically the whole basic training of becoming a soldier or even more extreme special forces is trying to replicate the hardship of what might actually happen in a tough time of your life, for example, in a war situation. So with all of that in mind, you're basically just reshaped as a human being. You would say and could say that you're becoming broken down first, and then they rebuild the pieces into something slightly different. So most of the, I've been working with multiple special forces all over the world, and the format is quite similar. So there's usually like a number of basic training weeks, usually like 7 to 10 weeks of, some people probably call it hell. Hindsight, I thought it was quite easy, but when I was right in it, it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy at all. But when you look back,
How physically fit were you going into this?
I was very prepared. So I had prepared for more than 2 years to actually be in a position where I could like carry very heavy. I can do many things. I knew lots of the how to use many of the weapons. So I had many of the prerequisites sorted out. So it became easy for me because I had prepared. That's something I can encourage anyone to do for any kind of challenge in life. If you can prepare, then it's easier for you and on you. So with that said, with any kind of like competition and selection process is one of them. You can choose to be the best one, but then usually you piss people off. And usually you can be the bottom one, or you can try to hide somewhere in the middle. Usually the people are picked off from the bottom, usually, in any kind of like selection process, or people get injured, or people leave for their own personal reasons. So how does that change your own mind? Because after the foundation, you have passed so many tough things, and also going on after in the rest of the training. So You trick yourself, almost become, you think that you're almost like invincible. That doesn't sound very humble, but it isn't either. You have to think that you're invincible. Otherwise, how can you be so crazy just charge on sometimes an enemy which is way superior, for example, in terms of numbers? And just because of that mindset and thinking that you are better, you're worth more, just that it is not good or right always to have that mindset, but sometimes it's really the right way as well. So think about in business, if you think that you are better prepared, you are in a stronger position, and now you enter a negotiation, it's so much easier than when you feel like that, not necessarily to show that, but mentally when you are there, mm-hmm. it's so much easier to do any kind of challenge in life. So that's superiority is one thing. And on the other side of that spectrum is like to be humble, which is exact opposite. The best soldiers, especially the people who move on to, for example, intelligence service later, they are the people who can actually control that mindset, not to show everything.
Let me ask you a question.
Go for it.
So you've got this mindset that you adopted or learned in special forces training. How do you transfer that into business personally? Like, how do you get into that mind state again, like when you're going into a negotiation?
Yeah, I would say that the mix of preparation and thinking about the small details, because that's usually how you make the difference between the professionals and the real professionals. They pay attention to the small details. They're all the small 1% better in many aspects. I translate that into, for example, negotiation in terms of how I prepare, how I listen, how I position my offer, and also being a little bit street smart to allow the other person maybe to show the cards first. So you can, the more information you got, basically, and the more information you acquire, that you're in a stronger position to play your cards later. So,
okay, so you don't necessarily have a routine that you do to get into that mind state. Is that mind
no,
state?
No, it's unfortunate. It's very hard to untangle it. It's very much unconscious competency. So how to get into that? Yes, some of the things that can help is the breathing, like the preparedness in like the whole day. For example, if you start your day with some kind of like good routine, for example, exercise. So even before you come to that meeting, you're already a winner because you've done your morning exercise or whatever your routine is. So you're already a winner regardless how this ends. So all of that puts you in a really good frame of mind. So you can...
So let me share, task. If I can, because I was looking for like a tool to help people, like, because sometimes people aren't in that confident state of mind. How sometimes they aren't. That invincible state of mind. And one of the things that I'll teach my clients is called the circle of power. It's a sports psychology technique.
Yeah.
And so, you know, just to give you a quick run through, to give the listeners a quick run through, it's, you know, imagine yourself performing at your very best. And it could be, you know, in a sport, it could be in a negotiation, it could be in a relationship, but imagine yourself at your peak and imagine how you felt. And imagine what you were thinking at that moment, and then freeze that picture in your mind's eye.
Yeah.
Imagine a circle around you in your mind's eye, could be any color. And then what you want to do is imagine bringing that circle up and then putting it down around you right here, right now. And, you know, you're deep breathing during this circle of power exercise. And what it does is it tells your brain that you're in the same physiological state that you were in back when you were performing at your peak. So it's a really quick exercise that you can use to transfer that mindset and that physiology to you right here, right now.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah. And another thing, talk about to add to what you said there, like words leads to pictures, leads to feelings in our minds. So you might have your right trigger word that you can say to yourself to get the right picture. So all of a sudden, you know, in the right frame of mind. So for example, when we spoke about the word peak performance earlier in this chat, I thought about when I was teaching people to be peak performance in terms of buoyancy as a diver. Mm-hmm. Like everything is so right position all over your body. And you now have got the right amount of air in your suit or your buoyancy control device. And now you're so perfect, so you're literally flying. You're completely still in the water. You can see the particles around you. And yes, with a time breathing in or out, you're such at a peak state. And again, whatever that picture might be to any of the listeners, find that picture and that word or that place you think about that can really be calming you down, for example.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's another sports psych study that really fascinated me. It was golfing, yeah. And they were looking at putting performance. And they had three conditions. One is think whatever you want and do the yes. putt. The second one was think 3 to 5 words about your routine, about correct motion.
Yeah.
You know, like pendulum or balance, and yes. think about your technique. And then the other one was think of one word that encapsulates the whole action of putting.
Cool.
So,
cool.
You know, follow through or balance. But what they found is the people that focused on one word, that peak performance word, performed better. So as you're talking about the buoyancy, I'm thinking, you know, yes. what's that one word you can think, you know, whether it's float,
yeah, exactly.
buoyant.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I love those kind of tricks and tips, right? Because I yeah. think they can make us, you're talking about that 1% better, right? And if yes. you're, I was talking to this guy the other day, and he was like, he was talking about the 99th percentile in terms of IQ, which I think this guy is. And yeah, I'm like, yeah. okay, if you're in a room full of people that are at the 99th percentile in IQ or above, the intelligence doesn't separate you from others.
Exactly.
What does separate you might be things like emotional intelligence, emotional literacy, storytelling ability, ability to connect, yeah. social skills. Those are the things that will separate you.
Yes. Yeah. I had another golfing trick here. I was interviewing one of the former head coaches of Swedish national team in golfers on the female side. Mm-hmm. So he spoke about like posture. So everything you said there, like the whole trigger, all of those things, when you're standing really right with the whole body, one way to do that is actually to, do you remember during the 1980s, those fitness girls with doing all the training? So they were clutching their glute basically. Uh-huh. But when you do that, when you actually stand up, you get a really, really good posture. Mm-hmm. Which also really helps the golf swing. So mm-hmm. they used to like, before they did it, that trick was to like, what I mean? And all of a sudden the whole, and that was their trigger to get into the zone. And as a side effect, they also got really good posture, and then off mm-hmm. they went, and that worked for them.
So the tip there for those listeners is clench your butt cheeks.
Exactly. And that works. I mean, if you think about it, when you're about to do a presentation, for example, all of a sudden now you've got really strong posture and chest up and all of those things, and you've got a good breathing going on, and all of a sudden you're off to a really strong start before you even said a word.
Yeah, and I think that good posture leads to greater confidence.
True.
And then if you're presenting, it comes across better.
So
here's something that I need help with that I was pretty excited about. You were yeah. talking about programming your mind
yes.
in special forces to take in more information, and here's the one I need help with, recalling faces and names.
Yeah, yeah.
Help me out there.
Yeah, let's start with the whole aspect of our senses. We can take in so many different things, but we can decide what we filter. I usually explain this. We got like a receptionist in the brain, which decides like, is this important or is it not so important? And that's very much linked to, for example, past experiences are part of this receptionist to-do list. Like, is this relevant at all or not? And even more important filter than all of those is like, is this relevant for the context of right now? So with all of that stuff going on, we have also got in the back of the room, we've got the archive where we can also recall information. So number one, how can we get more information in? It's if you think about like how we can, if you're about to buy a car or something like that, you can program the RAS in your brain. So like, you're now looking for buy maybe a BMW, and all of a sudden you see that this particular BMW everywhere. Mm-hmm. That's just one example of how you program yourself to actually open up the mind. So that could be, for example, you search for threats in a room or in the city. It could be how you look for opportunities. So nowadays, I see development sites everywhere. I'm in real estate. I might have to mention that as well. before, I used to see like what are the best positions for snipers, which look very suspicious in this room, and all of that is like, what do you program yourself to look for? And you can literally unlock so much more of your perception, both your eyes, your vision, all of those things can be unlocked if you start to practice it. So that's like how the information gets in, and how can you actually get access to it? The easiest way to do it is to have associations. For example, we have already had a chat before, John, before we've been on this podcast. So I can just take your face, your name, superimpose that on another John who I know so much better. So when I see you next time, I will also see the other person's name. And all of a sudden, I immediately know that, yes, this is a John. Because the John I know is even better. That will almost like be the trigger. And that's the first name out of the way, at least.
Yeah, the other thing I've heard is you can use the house technique where you walk through a house and put different things in different rooms.
Yes.
Because the mind tends to work that way.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, names and faces are getting harder for me the older I get. It's interesting.
Yeah. And another way to really make it stick is to actually use the name. If you hear the name and you don't use it, then it's more or less lost. So one way for us to meet up is to use your name twice. So we have met. I said to myself, like I told myself, like, okay, this is John. This is a picture of my brain of the other John. And then I use the name one more time, like, nice to meet you, John. Like, the first chance we have the chance to use it. And then before we say bye again, like, really nice to meet you, John. And now we've had it, we've said it to ourselves once and also to you and to you a second time. So now we use the name three times and we also heard the fourth time. So usually we just hear it and almost like a Teflon brain is gone. And often if the self-talk stopping us from remembering it, like, I'm so bad with names. Mm-hmm. So I will forget about John. And okay, that was you telling yourself, like, I shouldn't remember it, basically.
Yeah. So Frederick, I'm using your name again, so I'll remember it.
True.
So one of the things that I was thinking about when you first started talking about taking in information is just how amazing our attention is. I mean, attention, the more I learn about it, I guess the older I get, the more I appreciate it. For instance, we can focus our attention like a laser beam on a math problem.
Yes.
Or we can broaden it to sweep a room for threats, as you were talking about. I can, you know, if I'm playing soccer, I can broaden it to a 360 degree circle. So I'm aware of, or try to be aware of, everything that's on the field around me. And if I go scuba diving, it's a 360 degree sphere, because I need to be aware of what's above me and below me. And then the other part of it that enters into this is how important that same attention is with our loved ones, with people we work with. That, you know, it's so crazy that so much of, I mean, we get our feelings hurt if someone doesn't attend to us. We make bids for attention all the time. Hey, honey, did I tell you about this? Or you got to look at this with me. And we know that relationships that, you know, aren't getting those bids for attention met positively much of the time, those relationships are headed for destruction or, you know, breakup.
Yeah.
It's wild.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And just playing around with things. So thinking about it. So I will now, for the audience sake, I will cover my eyes. And just to, like, so today I'm talking to John, and he's got a blue shirt on. He's got his nice, cool tea mug, which has got his podcast name onto it, which is also on the back behind him. Also in the background, you got a nice framed thing there, which says up from, I guess, from the movie. In the bookshelf, what stands out the most is a skull, a figure of an ape, a very yellow book. And just behind John is also a thermostat, which he has adjusted early in this call. And he's sitting in a nice chair. So that's just like, that stuff I could have left out and completely missed. I'm now back to opening up my eyes. So those are just details for, like, just recalling and connecting bits and pieces. And it could also be like, what do you look like? Your face, how can I describe you? And just stuff like that.
Yeah, that was brilliant, actually.
It's so easy as to miss all of those things.
Yeah, nice detail orientation, good memory. So what about the other thing that really I was curious about is staying calm under fire. Like, how do you... You know, because one of the things that we thought was impossible was to stay calm. We didn't think it was possible to calm the startle response. And we've had, you know, I think it was Matthew Ricard, who they, you know, put into a deep meditative state in a lab. Yes. He was all hooked up to sensors. And then while he was, you know, eyes closed, deeply meditating, they fired a starter's gun off next to him. and he didn't respond. Like his, the muscles didn't flinch, the brain waves didn't change.
Yeah.
He was gone. He was somewhere else. And we didn't think that was humanly possible. And that's kind of what we're talking about here.
Yes.
You know, how do you stay calm? How do you think clearly? How do you perform properly under fire?
I would say number one, training. That you have actually been exposed to before. So you have, under more controlled forms, have had people shooting over you, next to you. You might have had explosions really close to you. So all of those things is like repeating and also getting yourself into a state of mind. But also rehearsing whatever you plan to do so much, you're almost like on autopilot. So almost like, regardless what's happening around you, unless it will physically stop you, you will just be on your track. You will do what's your thing. So you might have not seen some of the movies about how special forces operate and practice. And it's often like so many dry runs of the same thing. So that's why it's so easy to just get on track. But also, things usually never go exactly to plan.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you have got all of these alternative routes, so you can actually go to plan B, C, or whatever it might be.
And what about fear? Does fear come up? Or
Absolutely. I mean, if you're fearless, then you're actually dangerous. If you don't feel fear, you're a liability. I met people who literally don't feel fear at all. And like you said, I think it's sensible to actually react to stuff around you, obviously. Meanwhile, I have had training, so I can do many things without flinching and reacting. And that's probably one reason why my wife thinks I should work slightly more on my emotional IQ.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've been practicing that away. I mean, I was quite strong in terms of not focusing too much on the feelings before. So that's something I've had to like practice back into my life after the military and during military as well.
Yeah, I can imagine you were quite stoic. Like there wasn't much expressed. And the fear, I mean, I like the idea of making fear your friend. There's a story of, you know, Mike Tyson during his first professional bout, and his trainer was Custa Amato, who's a famous boxing trainer. And Cus said that, you know, Mike was scared shitless before that first round in the, you know, in the training, in the dressing room. And Cus told him, he said, you know, look at fear as a friend. He said, if you had a friend that saved your life multiple times a day, you wouldn't run away from him. You wouldn't try and stuff him. You would open your arms and say, thank you. That fear is there for a reason. I like to think of it as like my spidey sense, right? It's, you know, oh my gosh, something's wrong here. Something's, you know, I might be in danger. But I also think that for many of us, that fear comes up in situations that aren't life or death in this day and
age. Yeah, exactly.
We have to fine tune it.
Yeah, no, I think especially the fear can sometimes be very non-productive as well. I like productive habits. And sometimes the fear can really be people's way to do the most obvious choices in life and to do the daily tasks. For example, you might have some people listening in who are actually in sales and influencing skills, and often people shy away from the core fundamental things in sales, which might be talking to another person or lifting up the telephone, the super basics, because there is a risk of the no or rejection, therefore hesitating, faced, or not doing that action at all. And this is way more common than we think. And it also happens to me as well. Like, I'd rather do something else, which is funnier, than to do what I know I should do sometimes, of course.
Yeah, and I think that picking up the phone is a big one, the fear of rejection.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny. It's always interesting to me where fear / anxiety gets to a point that paralyzes us, where we can't do. And, you know, that's the point at which I think you need to reach out and talk to someone and maybe look for some help or some ways around that.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're doing super important work, John, with unlocking people who feel locked up by asking the right question, exercises and so on. I think it's super important, the work you're doing.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate that. So let's go to the next topic, which is related to all this, which is your mindset around stress and how do you handle stress? Because that's intimately related to fear and anxiety.
Yes. Right, now we're back to another unconscious competency here. I usually perform better under stress. That's usually what people say, but I actually like to have some pressure on because that's kind of been used to having that. So I react well towards deadlines. I really like time tasks. Not everyone likes those things. So examples of stress in my life is when things don't go to plan. That can be a stressor. To not be able to clone myself, that is often a stressor as well. Because I've got multiple companies I'm trying to run and also having a family and a wife still. So all of those things. And then lots and lots of customers. So one stressor is really when you can't serve everyone to the level you would like.
That's it gets back thing. To the beginning of the conversation where we were talking about disappointing others.
Exactly. So I don't like that, obviously. Other stressors, physical stress. I move so many boundaries. So I'm usually not stressed for physical things. That's just like the Duracell rabbit, like just going and going. As long as the cadence or pace is not too high, I can just keep going. So physical stress is usually not that much facing me. But many people are also stressed in terms of coming back to if you're not fit enough, you actually get also stressed because of the your physical daily life. So as I can highly recommend to reduce your stress, have some kind of, even if it's just a walk, anything like that can get your energy better and also the different, everything inside your body gets better basically by doing some extra exercise. I know that you do that from your experience as well.
It's interesting. A couple things come to mind as you were talking. One is one of the important things regarding stress is your mindset around it. And you hit right on it, which is successful people welcome stress. They thrive on stress. They're like, okay, here's my body giving me energy to ready me for a challenge. So I can think more clearly. I can perform better. I can perform more quickly. Stress is good. Now, a lot of the population looks at stress as bad.
Yes.
And it shuts them down and it can paralyze them. But that's simply a mindset switch, which you can make right now. Yes. You can decide to start looking at stress as a good thing, as welcoming it as energy. The other thing, you mentioned physical stress. And I was thinking, I was like, physical stress, like, holy shit. So I've got this condition lately called spinal stenosis, which means I get this incredible nerve pain frequently lately. And it's hitting like a 10 at times. And that is causing a lot of stress for me. Like I'm frustrated. It's really, really difficult for me. So I'm taking steps to get it handled, but physical stress is a big deal.
I mean, a crazy thing for everyone has to try. Next time you think it's really cold around you in life, you might have a cold weather or you might be in cold water, anything like, just try to get control of your breathing. And all of a sudden, like deep breathing in and out, and all of a sudden that shiver disappears in a second. It's super strange. And that can also sometimes help with what you mentioned there with your medical condition. The breathing can be one of the best things to fight pain.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I've had to redefine my relationship with pain and kind of turn towards it and welcome it and try to relax into it with breathing. And I can do it at times. Yeah. At times, take my breath away, right? But pain, like chronic pain, it causes you to breathe shallowly if you're not aware. Just like any negative emotion. You know, anger, fear, sadness, we're all breathing shallow, which means we're not getting the oxygen into our brain that we need to operate at peak. And, you know, the brain runs on two things, oxygen and glucose. It's really sensitive to minute changes in oxygen levels.
Yeah, I started laughing to talk about pain levels. It's not to make you fun out of your pain, obviously.
Oh, please, go ahead. You got to laugh.
It's just brought back so many memories.
Oh, shit.
How colleagues been relating to pain and everything from like, oh, you got your right leg is hurting, like hit yourself on your left leg and the pain will move to the other new spot. I've had many interesting ways how we can cure pain.
Well, let me know if you have more tips. I'm open. So the other question that I wanted to ask was, you know, in the Swedish Special Forces, you were known as the Smiling Lieutenant. What's up with that?
it was I was a lieutenant for a number of years and later captain and so on. Like you said before, you got a switch in your mind. You can decide whether how you take in what was happening to you as good or bad. You can choose to smile or not to smile. I was called the smiling lieutenant for many years because I was always like, regardless what happened to me, even was supposed to be really hard and bad, the situation, I was usually still smiling. And I've been smiling a few times in this podcast as well. So it's just a state of mind, really. If you choose to smile, people more often choose to smile back at you. And it's just like a candle, you share the light. The smile doesn't cost anything. And it gets so much more. It unlocks doors, creates better relationships, and you feel better yourself as well. Choice is yours.
I love that idea of, you know, making it a challenge for yourself to make any interaction you have with other people during the day to be their best interaction, their most positive, uplifting interaction of their day. Yes. And the crazy thing about, you're not always going to succeed, but the funny thing about it is when you do that and you smile and you engage, you find a point of connection, they smile, you smile, you walk away, you get a little positive emotional boost, and so do they. It's a win-win.
Yeah, but you're lucky. You live in America where it's okay to smile at people.
So you're in UK?
UK, if you smile at people on the train, it's like, psycho, what's wrong with this guy? Yeah. It's just like when you talk to people on the train, I usually talk to Americans on the train because they're so happy and natural to do it. But if you talk to a normal Brit, they will wonder almost like, why you talk to me? Like, mind your own business.
Well, it was funny. I think we live in a touch-deprived society, right? Like, touch is really important. Hugs, kisses, touch on the shoulder. And, you know, I think in this Me Too environment, it's even more so that we can't touch, which, you know, I get that part of it. And I think we can still properly, you know, give each other hugs. And, you know, like, I touch all my clients on the back shoulder.
Yeah,
because that's a safe place to touch people. But they did a study a while back and they looked at the number of touches that friends made during a 1 hour coffee visit in different countries. In the US, it was 2. So it was like hello and goodbye. In Puerto Rico, it was like over 120. And in the UK, in England, it was 0. So that might be part of the problem. Maybe. Very stiff upper lip, very reserved.
Yeah. And I'm born in Sweden, the same thing there, where it's better. It's somewhere in the middle, I would say.
And it's not the same throughout the U.S. too. I think New York is quite different than California. At least that's what I hear from East Coast people. You know, if you smile at people, they look at you like you're crazy or, you know, you're going to kill them.
I think the weather and the ocean makes people more happy as well in nature. Yeah,
absolutely. Water. I think water is really rejuvenating.
Yeah.
It's restorative. And yeah, I think the sunlight helps. But it's funny, you know, I really like to mess with social norms.
Me too.
Because why not? I don't know. I'm always willing to make an ass of myself to make other people laugh. But there's some embarrassment that comes at the same time. Yeah. So, you know, I'm telling my clients, like, you know, let's get comfortable with embarrassment. Let's go out there and make an ass of yourself because we men in particular do so much to keep us from being embarrassed. And if you think about it, it's just fucking embarrassment. Like, it's not that big of a deal. Like, it's an emotion that comes and goes in 30 seconds, but we spend a large part of our lives trying not to be embarrassed.
Yes.
And for what?
Yeah, no, exactly. It's just the same thing. We're like, we're all naked under our clothing.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard. Same thing there with like, what is a huge big deal? But again, this comes back to culture and so on.
So here's a question I have, and you may not have a complete answer to it, but I'm really curious, especially, you know, having been special forces, having been the smiling lieutenant, now in a marriage. What does masculinity mean to you? Like, what are the pieces of masculinity that you think are positive and maybe other pieces which aren't so positive?
I think that unfortunately, with everything from the Me Too to everything else in society, that men are becoming a lot less manly. They're becoming almost like... I almost like refuse to use the word. In Sweden, they have, over the last 10 years plus, introduced a new word. It's not he, it's not she, it's just in between. Is it wrong to say he or she? No, it's not. It's okay. Coming back to your question about manlyhood and man traits, I think it's okay with some of the old stereotypes. I think many people still appreciate that.
Like which pieces specifically?
Well, that's a great question.
Strength.
I'm kidding.
Physical strength. I think.
Yeah, I like physical strength.
Provider for the family. But then there's some that I think are interesting because I think they can get to extremes and be a problem. For instance, self-reliance. Like we're brought up to be self-reliant, right? It's a team of one as a man. And I think to some extent that's good, but I think we take it to the extreme. And if you're looking at a 1 to 10 scale and you take self-reliance to a 10, like you refuse to ask for help when your leg is bleeding or cut off, or you need, like I had a friend's dad that would pull out his own teeth with pliers in the garage because he didn't want to go to the dentist. Well, you could say that's self-reliant, but it's not healthy.
No, I agree. Yeah. I think a tough question. I'm probably not the right person to talk and give you an easy answer because I am in many aspects, I'm a feminist. I'm very much for the women's rights. And also that is really strong in Sweden. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I like manly things. And what that means to you, that I leave that to you. But everything from... what is it called? A friend of mine who is watching different YouTube movies than me. He's got a channel, I think it's called Dude Stuff.
Okay.
And that's everything from how to operate heavy machinery to how to lit a fire to think almost like, come back to the name of your podcast, the caveman kind of things. Anyway, I'm not the right person to answer that question. What does it mean to you?
Well, I mean, that's the reason for the title on the podcast, because I think that we do have that part of us that's caveman, right? Yes. I mean, that, there's strength there, there's courage, there's determination, there's perseverance, all that stuff is good stuff. And then I think that if we want to stay happily married, because I think, the job definition for us as husbands has changed dramatically in the past 50 years. Yes. Once women got into the workforce, started earning money, there was less reliance on us for financial security.
Yeah.
And so their definition or their expectations of a husband, I think, have changed quite a bit. And I think that along with that traditional stuff, they now want a lifelong romantic partner that is empathetic, supportive, communicative, emotionally aware, as you were saying, supportive. And we have not been socialized in that direction. So it's not our fault, but I think it is our responsibility to tack on some new skills to that stereotypical, definition of masculinity and manhood. Because to me, the goal in life is success and happiness at work and at home.
Yes. Yeah, I agree.
If you're missing one of those four, you got a problem.
Yeah. And I would say one reason why I've been together with my wife now for a long while, it's like 27 years-ish, which is a lot.
Congratulations. That's huge.
Thank you. And one reason why that is the case is, ironically, absence. So the reason why that's been working so good is in the first few years, she had some time where she could also go as an au pair and work in other countries, study abroad. And she has, it's really unusual for any wife to survive a military career. So we've been together since before the military career, during the military career of 16 years, and many overseas deployments for myself. And still today, more than a decade on. So having said all of that, when you're not together all the time, I think it's less of the nagging. But one thing that the being absent brings to the problem is you can move at different pace. Mm-hmm. You can evolve in different directions. So that's a challenge to manage. But otherwise, it's quite nice to be in love, like a new in love, like have that feeling after mm-hmm. being together for that many years, because you've been missing her for the last 2 weeks, and now you get to see her, and it's great.
Yeah, I would think that the absence would increase your gratitude and appreciation, for her, appreciation of her.
Yeah, and also because think about like values in life. One of my most important values is freedom. If I would feel too pinned down by an employer or in a relationship where my presence is, for example, really demanded to be like 24/7 there, it probably wouldn't have been working out. Mm-hmm. So depending on how you rate your values and family, that is of course different.
Yeah, and I think the bringing the values in is a really important point. You know, what are your personal values, and then what are your values together as a couple?
Yes.
And I don't think most people have an awareness of one or both of those.
I agree.
So just having clarity on it is really helpful in terms of making the relationship more successful.
Yeah.
Well, Frederick, I got to wrap up. So let me ask you one more question. Where can people get a hold of you if they would like more information?
Cool. So my name is Fredrik Sandvall, Swedish spelling. So check out the show notes. And you can find me literally anywhere on Google and on social media. I'm particularly fond of LinkedIn. I have got a podcast, which is called Invest in You. And I also got a book. But all of those things you can find if you Google me online. And I'm very happy to connect and help people wherever they are. And that's it.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And that is it for this episode of The Evolved Caveman.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.